I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Happy President's Day. We're listening to Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. This is my guest,
Robert Sietsema from The Village Voice.
Excellent. And this is I already said this is Heritage Radio.
I think the commercial said it before us.
All right.
Yes, it is.
We're all set.
Someone asked me, is that like a right-wing heritage foundation? And I had to say, no. This is like a left-wing thing.
Wow. I haven't heard that because I hear heritage tossed around in heirloom so much.
Yes, for us it's a positive word, but right. To the rest of the country, heritage often means the Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank,
I think. So much. Speaking of words being, used and then defined in different ways, misused or hated, what about the word foodie?
That's great. Friends and I have been talking about the word foodie for quite a while now, because foodie went from being like an incredibly positive word to being a neutral word to kind of being now like almost pejorative. Mm. We kind of make fun of foodies now, even though we, I guess, are foodies, aren't we?
Yeah, I guess in a broad sense, the term means snob, right?
Not only snob, but somebody who's kind of like picky in a useless sort of way about what they eat. Mm-hmm. I guess it could be someone who worries about, sourcing all the time, or as we do, of course, mm-hmm. or someone who is just like really snobbish in a useless sort of way and doesn't like the way things taste. The kind of person that sends things back in a restaurant because it's not exactly what they expected, rather than proceeds empirically as we do just to see what it's going to taste like.
See, my impression would have been the foodie would be someone who eats with an open heart and mouth and everything that comes.
That's the old meaning of foodie.
Yeah. Okay.
But now foodies have kind of made themselves obnoxious in the popular culture as the foodie net has spread. As more and more people have become associated with foodism and with the idea of being so obsessed with food that that's your most important activity in life. You can see how this is already kind of going in a negative direction.
How does this even happen?
Like, are we interested in anything besides food? Do you ever talk with anyone about anything but food? I'm trying to see if we can get out of squirrel out of this foodie kind of label that we have stamped on our foreheads. We both have, as we're sitting here, tattoos on our foreheads that say foodie.
Mm-hmm, so exactly.
It's hard to kind of like pretend to not be a foodie.
Well, what do you call yourself if you're a music junkie? Because I know that you are.
I'm a music junkie. I just call myself a junkie. Actually, I'm a musicist. No, there's no word for
musy.
You see, you're still allowed to enjoy music as kind of a positive value without being labeled as. And I mean, unless you're in a rock band or something, or a classical composer or something, in which case that you probably have to deal with people in the music business you don't like all the time.
I think that warrants a certain amount of respect instead of disdain. I think that a lot of people who accuse people of foodies just can't get into it. They're just not interested. And so,
We have that guy B.R. Myers that recently published that scree against foodism, against foodies.
Was that in the Atlantic?
It was on The Atlantic, And I had the privilege of being proximate to my computer when it came up, so I was one of the first to reply to him, and I, of course, defended foodies.
Right.
Well, while also kind of like damning them with faint praise. And I found that it was interesting as the responses against him piled up, what the tone of the various responses were. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there was a bunch more, too. I mean, anything you barf up onto the internet immediately gets responses.
Right.
And there's so many food writers that I think there's more food writers than there are non-food writers. I think there's more. It's probably the largest group in the entire population of New York right now would be identified as food writers. Well, you yourself have seen that. Like, we're both, to some extent, professional food writers, but we've seen our ranks so swelled with people that write about food, often without not even liking food. It's just because it's popular, because it's a topic that is on everyone's, you know, mind all the time. And just the number of increase in restaurants that has popped up all over the place, and the popularity of restaurants. And
you know, I started out, I started out as a film critic, reviewer.
Really? Oh my God.
And somebody was asking me last night, they're like, so did you study food writing? I'm like, there is no such thing.
There are universities have entire departments in some cases, but certainly programs in which one can be certified as a food writer. And once again, we are several steps from reality here, because it's not even necessary to like food to be a food writer. Like, that guy, B.R. Myers, is now a food writer, even though he hates food and really he hates people that write about food and he hates foodism. I mean, we have time in the next program maybe to celebrate the positive values, but maybe we should be talking now about the negative, the monster that foodism has created. And for us, it's a personal monster, because I've seen the amount of money paid to food writers dwindling. I mean, in my own career in food writing, I make a decent living, but not an opulent one. And I've seen a lot of my clients, like, go down. The amount of money that they pay for things has gone from a high of, like, $3 a word down to 15 cents, 5 cents a word.
And then I noticed that other topics, like if you write about design or fashion or something, get paid more, for the same publication.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know
so, why. And it's, you know, there's just so many people out there. And so many people that are just not good writers. So they're neither real foodies or real writers. So, and of course, with the web, you can publish anything anywhere. And now,
well, how do you suppose the cream will rise to the top?
Well, I don't think it will. I think it'll sink to the bottom like a turd. Is it cream or is it turd? I mean, once again, what is food writing? Is it cream or is it turd?
How did this become so popular?
Well, it's partly, without puffing ourselves up too much, it's partly the fault of us and people that like us who were so enthusiastic, and the enthusiasm became contagious. And then inevitably the capitalist moved in and figured out ways to make money off of this. And suddenly, well, we were just talking about Roberta's. Do we dare talk about Roberta's right here?
Sure.
Roberta's, we are sitting in a boxcar, a shipping container, which has been retrofitted as a radio studio. We have a picture window looking out onto an area that was once a kind of outdoor fire pit for the restaurant Roberta's, which was for a couple of years Foodie Central. It was a place where we all would congregate, where we all, you know, all the people that identified either as food writers or food fanciers or people who are really interested in food, and especially the political aspects of food. I mean, that was extremely important. You know, and the modern foodie is not really interested much in the politics of food. They're interested in the glamour of food.
Well, I would hope more are interested in the politics of food.
Well, not anymore. I mean, the people that are interested in the politics of food are more like a small kernel of old souls. And like I say, we used to congregate here at Roberta's. And now what used to be a fire pit is now an extended dining room, and Roberta's has a wine steward, and they're just, you know, they have become a full-blown...
They foodied it up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's just, those of us who were here in the early days don't even recognize it anymore, even think it has changed for the worse in becoming like a, you know, a powerhouse of a restaurant that... Even the hilarious and ridiculous Michelin guide, which is just like the worst thing imaginable. You know, even they have discovered this place and written it up. So, you know, it's like, but when Michelin arrives at a restaurant, you better like get your hat and run.
So where do you think the real like hub of kind of... foodie, and I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, M. Wells for a while was the place where food, you know, the foodies were hanging out. But I think there's going to be a price on our heads, and there are going to be people sent out with rifles and stuff to shoot the original foodies who still maintain those what now seem like ancient values.
Yeah. So
I'm talking like a cynic. Don't believe a thing that we're saying here.
No,
but
no. I totally hear you. So, like, because I know that you have, you're very, I guess, principled about how food writing should be done, and you're kind of old school about making sure that you, for instance, are incognito. You don't accept gifts from restaurants, and you go there at least 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
Every place you ever review for Village Voice has gone to 3 times. And you don't make special exceptions and so on and so forth. Do you see that this is like on its way out, or how is this going to be upheld?
Well, most people believe that I'm not even anonymous, and I am. I mean, those of you who've gone out with me,
Robert's
know that
Robert's wearing weird glasses right now.
That's right. Yes, I'm always wearing weird glasses. No, but it's not even that. It's just my experience is that critics who are recognized want to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Because who wants to be like a micro celebrity unrecognized? Like, mm-hmm. you could be the most famous critic in the world, but if you were anonymous, then if no one is like recognizing you and kissing your ass, how can you exist as a critic? That's what people think. So
right.
My anonymity comes from my Midwestern upbringing, which means that I don't like to be fussed over.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I almost instinctively went for the anonymity of the traditional criticism as kind of established by Craig Claiborne.
But that also produces a level of trust with your readers so that they know that you're not being treated.
Right. You know. The most important thing to me is that I am on the side of the consumer. I'm not on mm-hmm. the side of the restaurateur, which is what allows me to kind of like diss Roberta's here, just mm-hmm. like sitting here, even though they might come and kill me or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that almost all things that masquerade as reviews now are done with free food that's cadged. Well, let me give an example. I recently went into the new Bowery Beef. And they don't know who I am. I mean, I just went in there and I got a beef sandwich. I sat there and I ate it by myself. I kind of like, you know, I enjoyed it immensely and I wrote about it. But as I was there, there were a couple of bloggers from a blog whose name I'm not going to mention, but they were there and they were just like, they were living high on the hog.
Oh.
You know, even though this place serves nothing but roast beef sandwiches, they managed to cadge a couple of free roast beef sandwiches and they were sitting there and they were just basking in their own, you know, mm-hmm. reflected light. And they were like criticizing the sandwich and saying, oh, if this sandwich, I think you should change the roll, you know, and like the person that owned the place was kind of dutifully listening.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, you know, they're going to go and they're going to write about the sandwich and it's all under kind of false pretenses.
Maybe that's why there's so many food writers now. It's like free sustenance.
Oh, exactly. You know, and so, yeah, I have no objection to people accepting free food from restaurants or whatever, but then to write about it as if they're
saying that
they received the free food, that's where the crime comes in as far as I'm concerned. So
are you going to wear your masker costume at the South by Southwest panel?
Oh, definitely.
You're going to be on
yeah.
Food, Media, and Ethics?
Yeah.
Check it out, guys.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm so delighted to be going back to Austin for the South by Southwest because I instinctively avoid those kind of festivals because I love to go to rock shows, but the idea that, you know, there's herds of cattle kind of like going from show to show and you never know if you're going to be able to get in the door or not.
Now there's herds, well, I'll
herds
tell you about
of foodies
later.
Going from place to place.
Yeah, it's kind of turning into a lot of food things. I was there 2 years ago and that was the first food media panel. It was like food blogging. And now last year, I don't know if there was, oh yeah, there was a couple. And now there's, I hear a lot. Of food related.
Yeah, there are many, many. I was shocked to look on the roster and see how many food panels there were. And, you know, I just, it's so weird. It's, you know, South by Southwest. They're, I guess it's time for the break, right?
Yeah. And after the break, more food media on the show.
Tell me. public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we're back on Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. This is Robert Sietsema, longtime Village Voice food critic.
Hi.
Hey. So we were just ranting about how far things have changed, and this seems like a, you know, very significant topic that you've been writing very eloquently about lately.
Oh, thank you.
So I can't wait to see what happens at that panel. There'll be forks flying through the air. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, there may be. I mean, it's a kind of interesting panel. There's also like someone who's Ben Leventhal, mm-hmm. who's the partner of Josh Ozersky in Ozersky TV. So I think that they must have put him on there to kick my ass. So
because you famously have this squabble after your open response to Josh Ozersky. Yeah. Okay.
And I still love Josh, of course. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm sure he hates me. But, I blew the whistle on him last year for basically receiving $100,000 in free food and free space from restaurateurs and restaurant empire builders, and then writing about it on the blog of Time Magazine as if everyone should do this, and not disclosing that he'd received it for free. Now, he's kind of like dealing with a tax loophole there, because normally he would have to pay tax on $100,000 worth of free stuff. But because it was his wedding, he's able to weasel out of the tax responsibility, but not the ethical responsibility of when you're writing about something like that and you've received it for free, you must mention that.
Well, I think that response really opened a lot of dialogue on how food.
It was fun, right way to put it, because there were people that lined up on both sides, you know, and it really split the foodie community down the middle. I mean, this was one, you know, to go back to the idea of what's happened to foodism. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had several different phases that it's gone through, and everything for the last 3 years or so has served as a wedge to divide the hardcore foodies from one another. Another of those wonderful wedges, which have made things so interesting, is the wedge that you created, which is let's eat at home. You know, let's not go out to dinner every night and catch free food from restaurateurs because we're big, important foodies. Let's, like, go back to the values of eating at home and making things at home. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that when you eat at home, you can control the sourcing of what you get. You can buy from the farmers markets or a CSA. You can make sure that what you're buying has been humanely produced if you do eat meat or flesh of any sort, and I do. But whatever it is, you can control the conditions under which what you're eating has been produced, which was one of the keystones of foodism in the early days, was how can we seize, you know, our eating habits back from the multinational corporations that produce the crap that's making kids fat in the schools, et cetera. So.
Well, I'm hoping foodisms, because, you know, I learned about how things are produced through just having a ravenous appetite for good food, and made me realize, oh, there's so many other reasons why this bunch of chard is good, you know, because it was raised with a lot of TLC, so forth. And I feel like that's just a natural progression that will happen with anyone who has a real passion for good food. We'll see.
Well, there's so many people, though, that are cut off from those original values through the popularization of foodism.
Yeah.
You know, and I use the term foodism. People have asked that we not use the word foodism. Mm-hmm. I mean, just mainly in comments on the blog that I write for, Fork in the Road. People have said, well, this foodism implies religion, and that's the whole idea. I mean, that's why I love to call it foodism, because it has become a religion almost.
Can somebody write a little glossary for me, because I'm getting all mixed up. Foodism, foodie-ism,
foodie-ism. See, that's one step away from, but foodism sounds like what it is, which is a religion, and I would say that is an accurate description of the way us and our friends have treated food.
All right,
food.
I'll try to stick with
Don't
that
Don't you
one.
Worship food, kind of? I mean,
I do, yeah. What was the last good thing you cooked?
The last good thing I cooked? Well, I'm actually in the middle of writing something about how I make buffalo chicken wings.
Ooh.
So I have my own like special
recipe.
You have
your special
sauce. And it started out, as many recipes do, with researching on the web and trying to figure out how buffalo wings were originally made. And, you know, usually you go into a bar now and the wings can be completely indifferent, either really good or really bad. But there's nothing I like better than taking a recipe and kind of making it my own.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like to do is to substitute Chinese celery for
Chinese
American
celery. Is so superior.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe nobody's found this out yet.
I know. You know, I always thought when I first started writing about food that one of the upshots would be that chefs would read what I wrote and start incorporating things from a diversity of cultures, which I regarded as a positive value, the fact that I was, like, introducing people to cultures that were alien to them. And I thought, well, wow, somebody's going to read about when I start writing about palm oil used in Africa or about Chinese celery.
And start harvesting,
you know, I would see it on the bistro menu.
And, yeah.
And no. It's because the chef schools, the cooking schools, are a very negative force in the world of food. The idea that people that don't even like food, that are buy into the glamour, they go and they spend the $60,000 and they go to the CIA or something, or they go to the French Culinary Institute. Hey, folks, doesn't that say everything about it, the French Culinary Institute? Like, I love French food. But the idea that French food is the model for international cooking, the fact that it's not the Chinese restaurant school, it's the, you know, the fact that Asian food has been isolated from the purview of these schools.
Well, they do have an Asian program.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, and I'm sure that it sucks.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, really. And so this is controlling the way people think about food, going to these brainwashing schools and blowing all this money and mortgaging the house to go to cooking school, you know, and then you have this set of ideas that doesn't include using Chinese celery because you don't know it exists.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that the phones are lighting up now, even though we're not having any calls by people getting irate.
718-497-2128.
Come on, I'm like that guy that in the fair, Dunk the Idiot. You know, I'm sitting on this little swing, and if you throw a baseball and you hit this target, I'm going into the soup. So I'm going into the very European soup. So, yeah, no, just going to Flushing, just the range of ingredients and different kinds of preparations.
We were driving around Flushing the other day, and it was like a kid in the candy shop. Like, there was not a place we were passing by that I wouldn't mind trying.
Oh, yeah.
And I never have that feeling, you know. Well, I mean, you know, when you're at the farmer's market, I want to try everything, you know, here. But restaurants?
It's common enough for chefs to go to the farmer's market. That's one of the tropes of chefing now, is that you send one of your underlings, you know, on this painted bicycle with a big basket, and you come back. Although now, over the last few years, now, of course, the farmers make their own special devil's bargains with the chefs and stuff to deliver the choicest morsels. But that's something you must fight all the time, is how do you get exactly what you want? Like when the fiddleheads come in and you go to the market and there's none there because all the chefs have bought them
off. Well, the ramps is just funny.
Well, the ramps, they've now overproduced. The fact of the matter is, this is hilarious. I knew it when ramps started becoming popular, that from my time hiking in the Catskills, I knew that the supply of free ramps is unlimited.
Yeah.
So,
you know, there's still so much funky stuff that hasn't become popular. I find it every single week at, you know, for instance, Evolutionary Organics. That's a great one.
Uh-huh.
All crazy kinds of turnips. I've been doing a lot of turnips this winter.
Nice. That's something we've learned from the Canadians, that all of these Montreal restaurants that have come down here, from M. Wells to Fedora, you know, to Mile End and stuff. There's a certain Canadian sensibility that comes from 20 years ago, when the Canadian dollar was so weak that the idea that they would be buying all of this produce from Chile and from California.
Oh, I see.
So they did this traditional thing where they eat hog products all winter and they eat all these root vegetables. So beet salads and turnip salads, exactly what you're talking about, was their winter vegetables.
Why not? You know, how it's so hard. There's nothing at the farmer's market in the winter.
There's everything. I mean, and there's something healthy and honorable about eating as our forefathers and mothers did, of eating winter vegetables in the winter.
Honorable.
Yeah.
It is responsible. It is humble, modest, too.
Yeah. And,
you know.
And many people believe it's really good for you, too, because your body then.
I think it is. I mean, if you live in this environment and this is what grows year-round, season to season, it's good for you. I don't know. Like, I've been reading a lot about macrobiotics. it's kind of dorky, but like root vegetables, for instance, have a grounding energy, so they kind of stabilize you, make you feel more settled energy-wise. And that's I guess, I feel like that's a good feeling to have in the winter.
Oh, yeah, but they're also just plain good.
They are plain good, and they're immensely versatile.
Well, and people have known, too, that some of the best cooking is done within religious or philosophical restrictions, whether they're the restrictions of the foodie or the restrictions of the Buddhist monk or the restrictions of the macrobiotic person.
Or the kosher, whatever.
Or the kosher, yeah. You are when you are constrained, you often produce the best food, you
Small
know, with a more limited palate.
Choices.
And I don't mean throwing everything that's into your refrigerator in the pot,
right,
because that often results in the worst food. But
well, let's talk about another set of choices. Choice eats. Village Voices, third annual.
Fourth annual, actually.
Fourth annual.
Yeah, I am so happy this year about Choice Eats, because every year we have, as the festival has become more popular, we have like been able to attract even more and more obscure restaurateurs. Like we have two African restaurants represented.
From
the West Africa. One of them is Buka, which is a Nigerian restaurant, and the other one is in Queens.
Okay.
And it is from what is the, I'm trying to remember the name of it.
For anyone who doesn't know, Choice Eats is when Robert picks a whole lot of restaurants that you should know about throughout the five boroughs, right? The most craziest, best restaurants, and gets them all into this big space. It's an old armory, and you get to sample everything. It's a really
wild
experience.
You pay
experience.
I think the advance tickets are $35.
It's nothing.
Yeah, and they also have alcohol sponsors.
Yeah, you could do like a VIP one, which is a little more expensive, and you have like some more perks. Actually,
I was opposed to that because I don't believe in class society. But
skip the lines or something.
It's a good deal, and they have a different selection, few extra ones, and you get to go earlier, and it's not so crowded.
You get to
go
earlier. So, yeah. There's actually a VIP hour, I believe.
That's right. Yeah,
and I was very pleasantly but very surprised that one of your associates over at Village Voice, and I don't know if you know about this, asked me to do a cooking demo for the VIP hour.
I think I suggested it.
Oh, good, yeah, good. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yes, and they're always trying to do new kind of new things, and one of them that I suggested was like a cooking hour, and I said, well, try my son Kathy Irway and stuff.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I'll be...
So what are you going to cook?
I haven't decided yet, but I have a few ideas. Maybe I'll do something with turnips now that I think about
nice,
it.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
Because it will still be kind of wintry then.
It'll
it's
be
what,
wintry.
March 28th
it's coming
or something,
up, March 29th, I believe.
Thank you. It's always
Tuesday,
on a Tuesday.
Yeah, at the Armory, 50 what something street.
27th, between 26th and 27th on Lexington. So
it's a wild time. I mean, it gets bigger and better, or just better each year. And
I have the privilege, because I'm anonymous, of just like going as an anonymous citizen and just like kind of like meeting and greeting my friends, but also kind of like keeping watch.
Should be a good time. So what restaurants are you looking forward to most? That
I can't say, because I love all of them.
Okay. They're like...
But yeah, we have an amazing mixture of kind of hipster restaurants and ethnic restaurants from all over the boroughs, you know.
What do you hope to get out of Choice Eats? Like, what is the ultimate goal?
To popularize all sorts of fringe forms of food that people have not been exposed to popularize the food of immigrants, but also of creative chefs. It sounds like a broken back concept, but the most important thing is just to have really great food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really good deal. It's like saying thank you to all
It's like a potluck party
exactly,
with all your favorite
yeah.
places in one roof.
Exactly. Or the places, of course, not everyone wants to participate, but we have a really interesting mixture of stuff.
Cool tradition. Thanks for doing it. I guess that's about all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for being on the show, Robert.
My pleasure, and I hope you invite
hopefully
me back again.
Hopefully again soon. I'd like to thank Jack Inslee and everyone at Heritage, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.
Well, I think part of the sourcing process to me is the most exciting, because you know you rent a car and you drive through the south of France, and you know you obviously have some appointments set up, but you know some of the most exciting things happen when you're just kind of winging it, and you meet a farmer at a wine fair, and he says, well, come back to my estate, and you're not quite sure where you're going, and you follow a guy in a Peugeot, you know, up a rambling hill, and all of a sudden you come across either a castle or a shack in the woods, and the guy's making wine out of the back of his, you know, house, or he could be making wine out of a major estate. You know, looks are deceiving, but you want to assume that someone with a very established chateau is making good wine, but 9 times out of 10, the guy out of the garage who's like super passionate is making these better wines, and they're maybe more rustic and less polished. So to me, like the restaurateur, the sommelier, this story resonates with them about the small farmer, you know, the guy who's making wine on small quantities, 80 cases, 100 cases. Those are the things exciting to Barterhouse, and hopefully the things exciting to our clients.